Welcome, folks, to the Indie Week. Our issue this week, October the 31st of 2024. And from the North Carolina Reading Service, I am John Federson, here to read to an audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. So let's get to our issue today. I understand that my two-week absence was not filled in by articles from the recently 2 weeks publication, so everything is pretty new here today, and there's a lot of election-related articles, and I'll start with one of them, the most recent one that came out on the Indie Week website. Poll volunteers are accusing Representative Aaron Paré and husband Wayne of intimidation at early voting sites. Just before 3 p.m. on October 17th, the first day of early voting, the Fuquay-Varana Police Department received a call reporting harassment at Hilltop Needmore Town Park early voting site. That caller, Wayne Paré, said a male, quote, of unknown description, was harassing his wife, Republican State Representative Aaron Paré, and voters waiting in line. The caller was not on the site, according to a police report. But the police interviewed Representative Paré, who said the man had yelled at her when she accidentally stepped across the no campaigning line. They also spoke to the man, who said he didn't yell but reported Representative Paré to an election official on site for breaking that rule. Police determined, quote, no crime was committed while on scene or before, and the call for service ended without incident. While the Parés made allegations of harassment in this instance, Indy spoke to six people and viewed complaints from eight more who described Wayne or Aaron Paré harassing or intimidating them or other poll greeters, mostly women, at polling sites in 2020, 22, and 24. Representative Paré declined to comment for this story. Wayne Paré did not respond to an email and phone calls requesting his comment. Andrea Biondi, a longtime volunteer poll greeter for the Democratic Party and the North Carolina Association of Educators, told Indy that Wayne Paré repeatedly harassed her during early voting in 2020 and 22. Biondi recalls that Wayne would stand extremely close to her while she was handing out literature to voters in an attempt to physically intimidate her and make her move. Quote, his body language was confrontational. He would stand so close to you, you'd want to move, but if you moved, then you'd lose your spot on the one section of sidewalk that was open. Bondi said, at one point I could actually feel him over my left shoulder. That's how close he was to me. During early voting in 22, Biondi says Wayne stood behind her and held a clipboard over her head with a sign that read, she just told a lie about my wife. Please ask me for the truth. The Indy viewed a photograph of Wayne holding the clipboard sign printed with those words. One day at the poll, Paré allegedly held a bell next to Biondi's ear and rang it every time she tried to speak to a voter. The same year, Biondi told the Indy, Wayne Paré and Steve Bergstrom, a candidate for Wake School Board at the time and former chair of the Wake County GOP, would team up to try to intimidate poll greeters. Bergstrom did not reply to an email and phone calls requesting comment. Biondi says, together they formed this pair of intimidators, and at one point, Wayne was on one side, Steve was on the other, and Steve was walking up behind both myself and another poller, sniffing us and saying, ew. Biondi also recalls Wayne asking her outright, do you feel intimidated now? And telling her husband, who was there with her, to control your wife. Biondi says she remained calm and tried not to engage. Other poll workers also told Indy of similar behavior from Wayne Paré. Biondi says women volunteering for the Democrats or the NCAE got the same treatment. She says, we called it waning. Wayne was waning at the polls. We would warn each other, Wayne is a bit wany at the polls, which means he was kind of manic and he was really just being aggressive. Bambi Lockhart, a public school teacher and seasoned NCAE poll greeter, also experienced aggressive behavior from Wayne Paré at the Hunt Center early voting site in Holly Springs in 2020 and 22. In 22, she said, Wayne would stand in front of me so I couldn't speak to voters and try to intimidate me by his presence. He would continually ask me what my name was and try to engage me in repeated conversation. When I didn't respond, he would take pictures of me with his GoPro camera he would keep on his hip. He would also take out his phone camera and take pictures of me. It took away from my ability to speak to voters. I was constantly worried about where Wayne was standing, if he was near me or coming toward me. Lockhart decided to contact Representative Perret about her husband's behavior, and the ND viewed an email exchange between the two from October 2022 during early voting. Lockhart wrote, "Your husband attempts to intimidate voters and poll greeters on a daily basis. He uses his phone, his hip camera, his words, body movement, and so much more." In her reply, Representative Perret CC copied a state capitol police officer and accused Lockhart of harassing her and her family. Erin Perret wrote, "Ms. Lockhart's behavior has been and continues to be irrational and inappropriate." Lockhart says Capitol Police never followed up with her. Soon after that email exchange on October 31st in 22, Lockhart was volunteering at the Hunt Center with Biondi, Biondi's husband, and other Democratic and NCAA poll greeters. Lockhart says Wayne Perret and Steve Bergstrom started harassing them. Wayne had his clipboard and bell. Both men were standing very close to the women volunteers. Feeling uncomfortable, Lockhart decided to call an NCAA lawyer, Verlin Port. When Port arrived at the Hunt Center, she says she remembers the scene similarly. Clipboard, bell, physical intimidation. Port reported the behavior to the election official in charge at the site, but he didn't take any action. Port told the two men they were preventing Lockhart and the other volunteers from exercising their First Amendment rights and that she might have to call the police if they continued. Port and Lockhart say the Perez and Bergstrom backed off for the remainder of early voting. Port collected witness statements from Biondi, her husband, and another volunteer who was there that day, and the statements that the Indy viewed align with Lockhart and Biondi's stories. A Democratic poll greeter named Marty Abruscato also had a confrontation run-in with Wayne Perret at the polls in 22. Abruscato told the Indy that Wayne got very close to him to block him from greeting voters, so Abruscato told him to get the hell out of my face. A voter reported the incident to an elections officials who called the police. According to Abruscato, the police left once he explained the situation. Another Democratic poll greeter who requested anonymity told a similar story about both Erin and Wayne being disruptive and aggressive at the polls during early voting. In 2020, she observed Erin Perret standing directly in front of a Democratic Party table to block voters' views and refusing to move when asked. Volunteer says it was like it was back in high school. It was a prom queen election kind of thing. In 20 and 22, the volunteer says Wayne Perret often, quote, monopolized the pathway leading towards the early voting site, blocking poll greeters from opposing groups. She said it got so bad in 22 that she asked a male volunteer to come stand next to her as a buffer. It solved the problem, and I was able to do my job and help the voters, she said. A second Democratic greeter, who also requested anonymity, experienced the same pattern of behavior from Wayne Perret. This greeter told a story about bringing her school-aged daughters to the polls in 22 for a volunteering shift. She watched Wayne Perret step across the buffer line around the voting center, which campaign volunteers are not allowed to cross, and reported him to an election official on site. The official reprimanded Wayne and then returned inside. Once he was gone, Wayne started following the greeter around and photographing her. She says there were times when my girls were next to me and Wayne would take pictures. I was really unnerved by that. Many of the poll greeters Indy interviewed say they had tried to report the Perret's behavior to the elections officials in charge at their site, but the officials were busy or unable to do much besides ask the Perret's to stop. According to Wake County Democratic Party, Kevin Creech, the party's voter protection hotline, received several reports about the Perret's during early voting 20 and 22, including reports of Wayne antagonizing female poll greeters and Representative Perret calling the police on people who complained about her or her husband. In 22, Creech says the Wake Democrats began teaching its poll greeters de-escalation methods because these confrontations were becoming so common at the polls. The Indy viewed 6 complaints Creech received about the PIPRAs during early voting in 22 and 4. In the most recent, a poll greeter at Hilltop Needmore site complained to Creech that the PIPRAs were there, crossing the buffer line, following Democratic greeters around. Wayne was apparently wearing a body camera. The Indy viewed the email complaint, which had identifying information redacted. Well, a book interview of a book called Beyond the Big Lie by Durham's Bill Adair, which was released on Atria Books on October the 15th. And I presume this interview from Indie Week of Mr. Adair was printed in this current issue, and so I'm going to read it. It's in question and answer form, and I'll start in a second. In 2011, former President Trump went on Good Morning America to tease a presidential run and declare a skepticism that Barack Obama was born in the United States, a conspiracy that soon proved so useful to his political profile that he became its champion. At the time, racist birtherism was considered shocking, and the mainstream press reported it as such. 13 years later, we've been worn down. Trump's prodigious lying has become a part of American political life. In a new book that pulls no punches with its title, Bill Adair traces the escalation of lying in contemporary politics. The title? Beyond the Big Lie, the Epidemic of Political Lying, Why Republicans Do It More, and How It Could Burn Down Our Democracy. True to the book's title, Adair urges readers to look beyond just the big lie, that is, that the 2020 election was stolen from Trump, and see how widespread and out of control lying has become in the Republican Party. Adair, a Knight professor of the practice of journalism and public policy at Duke University, is well equipped for this task. In 2007, he founded a fact-checking site, PolitiFact, which went on to receive the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for its coverage in the 2008 election. Beyond the Big Lie draws up a frank taxonomy of political lies, dives into Adair's early 2000s neighborhood friendship with Mike Pence and his family, where he got a front-row seat to Pence's descent into political opportunism, and looks at the radicalizing effects of social media. Ahead of an event at Flyleaf Books, the Indy sat down with Adair to talk about the election and learn more. So this is the Q&A portion. Indy says, "Hi, Bill. I'll start by saying, I'm sorry, your book is so relevant right now." "Yes, yeah," he says, "I'm the guest you don't want at your house." Well, you start the book talking about the balancing act of fact checkers, wanting to appear nonpartisan, but, you know, having to acknowledge that one party does consistently lie more than the other. I'm curious how you think that anxiety extends choices that journalists make about coverage. Sure, and there are different genres of journalism here, so let's take them separately. I think fact checkers do a great job. I don't think they put their thumb on the scale for either party when they're doing individual checks, and I think they try their best to get a good sampling of things to check. I also don't expect political fact-checkers to shout from the rooftops that Republicans lie more. When I started off this book, that's where I was headed. But the more I talked to political fact-checkers and others in journalism, I realized that's not just not realistic. But I do think columnists and sort of other entities, maybe universities or independent groups, need to collectively show this pattern because it is unmistakable and it is crippling our discourse. What I propose at the end of the book is some sort of a scoreboard that would be online, maybe even something like the national debt block that you see in New York City that calls attention to the latest lies, the total number of lies by party, to highlight this disparity. I really think it's a serious problem that there is such a disparity, And I think journalists have, like me, ducked the question because they want to appear impartial. It also seems not outside the scope of journalism, but bigger than journalism. Too big of a problem for journalism alone to carry. I agree. I think this is a systemic problem in our politics that one party has chosen to just adopt this as a strategy, and the other party has decided not to as much. That's not to say the Democrats don't lie. They do. In fact, checkers catch them in plenty of lies. But there is this big difference, and it's something that people should know. The book is called Beyond the Big Lie, and you make an effort to talk about the political climate of lying itself, and not just Trump. But I wonder if you can talk about the differences in the scope of lying you've observed between 2016, 2020, and this current year election. This pattern existed when I started covering Congress in the late 90s. I began to notice it covering tax bills. Republicans are just so good with their talking points, and those talking points often exaggerate things or even have outright lies. I began to notice the pattern then, and it got worse over time. People I talked to said it really became part of the Republican strategy with Newt Gingrich, who sort of cemented it as part of the Republican culture. By then, Trump really supercharged it because he lies so much every day, multiple times, that he normalized lying in ways that no other politician has. And those lies have, of course, been adopted by many members of his party about things like immigration. Here in North Carolina, we've seen it with FEMA and disaster relief, often linking disaster relief to immigration within these lies. It's just terrible what's happened. Of course, the lies get echoed not just by other Republicans, but by people in conservative media. And that has, I think, made the party's culture even more welcoming to lying. I wanted to ask about Western North Carolina. Beyond the FEMA stuff, are there other lies you've seen enter the lexicon during this disaster? Two phenomena have interested me in watching it. One is that some Republican politicians have been willing to speak up against it and basically say, hey, fellow members of my party, this is terrible. We shouldn't do this. FEMA has been here and been responsive, and the state has been here and been responsive, and we need to stop lying about it. So I have approached those Republicans who have done that. So that's one thing. But then Trump comes back and repeats the same lies that have already been debunked. This is someone who just doesn't care about what the facts are. He's just going to say whatever. This is something that was driven home to me by a psychiatrist who I interviewed in my chapter, The Lying Hall of Fame, who tried to explain Trump's lying, basically. He said it's not like Trump tries to justify lies. He just does what he thinks he needs to say at the moment. I don't want to phrase this as, are we screwed with artificial intelligence exactly, but how can news organizations handle and fact-check the rise of AI? We don't know how the bad guys are going to use AI. We also don't know how the forces of good are going to use it. We've been experimenting here at Duke with trying to use it to clone fact checks, with the idea that there's a shortage of fact checks around the country, and that having AI, you could generate cloned fact checks using generative AI in states where you might not otherwise have any fact checking. We call that half-baked pizza. Now, in the meantime, as you suggest, the bad guys are finding ways to use AI too, and that's hard to detect. In the same way that we can't, as faculty members, detect when a student uses generative AI on a term paper, it's difficult to detect when someone's using AI to create a fake message. It allows someone to hyper-target an audience in ways that haven't been possible before. Election day and the days following it are a vulnerable period for misinformation. How can the Indy and other news organizations help curtail misinformation in real time? I think we should be really careful about putting out the claims of the people who say they've won, about people who say there's shenanigans in voting. The people spreading lies after the election are going to try to develop themes in some of the falsehoods about the vote and we need to verify those before we allow any of them to get out. Counter-messaging comes from Wake County. After weeks of Moms for Liberty and the Michelle Morrow campaign disrupting Wake school board meetings, the Wake County PTA and dozens of concerned parents are fighting back by speaking out. Meg Schroeder was visibly emotional as she introduced herself to the school board as a mom of three kids in three schools. "I've never done this," she said, her voice breaking, "but I feel so very passionate, and that's why I'm here." In recent weeks, the Wake County Board of Education's bi-monthly public comment sessions have increasingly become a forum for conservative political vitriol and viral social media moments. Moms for Liberty and Michelle Morrow, the far-right candidate for state superintendent of public instruction, have been rallying their supporters to disrupt school board meetings over issues like graphic content in books. Recently, a teacher was singled out for wearing a tutu during School Spirit Week. But now, parents like Schroeder and the Wake County PTA are fighting back, bringing their supporters out in numbers to speak against book banning and to support school staff. At the Wake School Board's September 17th meeting, an Athens Drive High School student named Lorena Benson told the nine board members that her English teacher had assigned a short story that Benson said contained, quote, graphic, incestual sexual language that made her uncomfortable. A video of her two-minute speech spread across social media and landed on the Wake County Moms for Liberty Facebook page, where the moderator encouraged parents, quote, contact your child's teacher and make sure you know everything they are reading. At the next board meeting, a conservative Wake Forest pastor named John Amanchuku staged a protest during the public comment period, yelling justice for Lorena Benson and refusing to leave the podium after his speaking time elapsed. A large group of Morrow supporters wearing T-shirts emblazoned with her name clapped and cheered for Amanchuku as a guard handcuffed him and removed him from the meeting. Morrow was in the room and had planned that stunt with Amanchuku ahead of time. In an e-blast to her supporters the day before, she asked them to cancel their plans and join her and Amanchuku at the meeting. Her message to the Wake Forest Area Republican Club said, we need 50-plus people there in my shirts, standing behind John outside as he gives an interview to the press. This is the greatest commercial for our campaign, and it is free. 2 weeks later, the Wake chapter of Moms for Liberty, a far-right group that advocates book bans and anti-LGBTQ school policies, shared a photo of a male teacher, Adam Chu, at Martin Magnet Middle School wearing a long tutu-style skirt during Spirit Week. The post called the teacher perverse and asked group members to speak about it during public comment at the next board meeting. Chu took the attacks in stride, telling the News and Observer, I agree with Moms of Liberty that I was totally not pulling off the tutu, not my best look. Members of Moms did attend the October 15th meeting to talk about this tutu, disparage the board, and baselessly accuse public school teachers of grooming students, but they were outnumbered for the first time in weeks by a different group of public commenters. Schroeder, wearing a red Briarcliff Elementary hoodie, explained that her kids had been in Wake Public Schools for 11 years. She's also worked as a long-term and daily substitute teacher within the system and voiced major concerns about House Bill 10, a state bill that would divert nearly $100 million in public school funding toward private school vouchers next year if it becomes law. She said, I've seen firsthand what it looks like to be understaffed, underfunded, and undersupported. I am a newly single mom of these three kids, and I need these schools, teachers, bus drivers. Please don't take any more money from our schools. One after another, parents of students in Wake Public Schools took the podium to protest HB 10, to praise public school teachers, and call for better school funding. Wake County public schools are chronically underfunded by the state legislature, and the county government must fill the funding gap each year. Carrie Whitaker, a mom to a Wake County Public School elementary schooler, told the board, "Every time I send my child into her school, I'm literally flooded with gratitude because I know she's surrounded by dedicated, talented professional educators. The voices that might be ranting about book content or about what a teacher wore on Spirit Day, those voices are distractions from what really matters." And Whitaker urged the board to stay focused on school safety, public school funding, and teacher pay. As the commenters took turns going up to speak, Marie Dexter smiled and whispered words of encouragement to them from her seat near the back of the room. Dexter is president of the Wake PTA Council, a nonpartisan, all-volunteer organization that oversees the nearly 200 parent-teacher associations in Wake County. In a conversation with the Indy, she explains the role of PTA, quote, "not just fundraising and having fun runs and spring carnivals. At a time when far-right groups are routinely questioning the value of public education, PTAs are defending it." The Wake PTA Council sent out an email blast ahead of the October 15th board meeting asking members to come and speak about positive experiences they've had at their kids' schools, the power of PTA, and the importance of public education. Dexter says, "We were really trying to pack that room at the last board meeting to counteract the negativity that's been happening. The more we can say it, hopefully the more people will hear our message and not just the other sides." Dexter acknowledges it's not easy to counter message against groups like Moms for Liberty or the Morrow Campaign, who latch onto specific incidents to stir up anger towards educators and the school board. The PTA Council tries to stay above the fray. Quote, "We didn't put out any messaging about that issue at Martin Middle because it's kind of ridiculous from our perspective. The teacher was wearing a tutu during Spirit Week. If you guys want to go rant and rave about that, then you go and look a little bit crazy. We're not going to respond." Instead, the PTA Council tries to focus on legislative issues and elections that affect public education. Dexter says, "We know the state legislature is going to be meeting soon about HB 10, so that's really why we were focusing on getting the message out last week. And of course, we want people to understand the importance of researching their candidates." Moms for Liberty has found success sharing videos and calls to actions on social media, but that strategy has not been effective for the PTA Council. Dexter says, "We've tried in the past to do some social media posts, but all that's ended up happening is that groups like Moms have commented very hateful things, and then we've had to take those posts down." Moms for Liberty members often invoke the Parents' Bill of Rights law during school board meetings, especially when they object to certain books being assigned or accessible at school. The legislation is divisive. Critics say it discriminates against LGBTQ students and makes it harder for teachers to do their jobs. The Wake PTA Council offers a different view of family engagement in schools, why it matters, and what it should look like. Dexter says, "For us, family engagement is knowing what's going on in your child's school, being there to support the teachers, being there to connect with other families, to volunteer in the schools and help our kids with things like reading, writing, and math. It's not about parents being able to approve the curriculum." As for the part of the Parents' Bill of Rights that requires the school to notify a parent if their child changes their name or pronouns, Dexter says that kind of stuff is just hurtful to our students. If they can't talk about that at home and school is the safe place to talk, we want them to have somewhere to go, to be able to express who they really are. Dexter believes in the power of the PTA Council to shift the narrative around Wake County Public Schools, but she also acknowledges PTAs have their flaws, saying, "The difficult with PTA is that there's a very stereotypical view of a white mom who doesn't work, who's at the school all the time doing stuff." She hopes to encourage more engagement from dads. and black and Hispanic parents in the future, but she knows that barriers do exist to participating in a time-consuming volunteer activity like PTAs for now. Dexter is focused on its upcoming election, where several school board seats, as well as the state superintendent of public instruction position, are on the ballot. She wants to maintain a consistent PTA presence at school board meetings past Election Day. She says, if a certain candidate does win the superintendent position, I'm sure we will be busier than ever with our advocacy pushes. But even if the other candidate wins, we're still going to be taking positions and passing resolutions on important issues. Well, I went to do early voting just a couple of days ago, and I came upon this constitutional amendment on voters' ballots. And here's an article about that constitutional amendment. It's on voters' ballots, which seeks to codify that only U.S. citizens may vote in North Carolina elections. Progressive Democrats are urging a vote against it. Non-citizens may not currently vote in any election in North Carolina. The state constitution says every person born in the United States and every person who has been naturalized may vote. A statewide referendum on this ballot this year proposes amending that to say only a citizen of the United States may vote. The proposed change doesn't really make sense because anyone born in the United States or naturalized is by law a citizen. So, why did both parties in the state legislature overwhelmingly vote for a bill to put this confusing measure before voters? In a GOP press release in support, Republican House Speaker Tim Moore said, quote, recent efforts to allow non-citizens to vote would undermine the public's confidence in our electoral system and leave the door open for chaos and election fraud to take hold. Some cities, including San Francisco, do allow non-citizens to vote for local offices like school boards, but it's not clear what efforts to allow non-citizens to vote Moore is talking about, because again, the North Carolina Constitution does not allow non-citizens to vote in any election. South Carolina, Idaho, Iowa, Kentucky, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Wisconsin have similar measures on their ballots this year, although, like North Carolina, none of those constitutions currently allow for non-citizens to vote. The ACLU of North Carolina says this pointless bill aims to confuse voters, sow distrust in our election, and stir up anti-immigrant rhetoric. We will not stand for this misinformation. They joined groups like Democracy North Carolina and the League of Women Voters in advocating against the amendment. Senator Greg Meyer, a Democrat who represents Orange, Caswell, and Person counties, is one of the few legislators who voted against. He calls the referendum a Republican, quote, turnout tool to match all of their anti-immigrant rhetoric, and urges Democrats and progressives to vote against it. But the measure seems to defy even that simple categorization. Republicans have largely left it out of statewide messaging. It hasn't, like GOP talking points on immigration, inflation, and parents' rights in education, permeated local or national campaigns. It hasn't been mentioned at a single campaign event that the Indy has covered this cycle. That lack of information has left voters, Republicans, Democrats, and unaffiliated more confused than motivated. Some corners of Reddit have worried that this amendment could be the first step down a path toward possible disenfranchisement of naturalized citizens. Meyer doesn't see it as that sinister, but he's still annoyed it's even on the ballot to begin with. And he says, I don't understand why any Democrat in the legislature would have voted for it. The Constitution is a document that's foundational to how we build and maintain our democracy. It shouldn't be a political toy. Because every Republican lawmaker in the General Assembly voted for the bill, it would have passed, even without any Democratic support. And although Triangle Democrats seem to disapprove of the bill, their votes don't always make that clear. Durham Representative Marsha Morey, who voted against the bill, suspects that some Democrats voted for it were worried about handing political ammunition to Republican candidates on the campaign trail. She says, if I had a contested election, a flyer would go out saying, Morey votes against citizen-only voting. Many of the Triangle's legislators, though, are not in competitive races. In a statement to Indy, Durham Representative Zach Hawkins, who is running unopposed for re-election, called the amendment a cheap attempt to distract from the real issues my GOP colleagues have neglected in the General Assembly, and a signaling bill that changes nothing for North Carolinians. But Hawkins still voted for the bill, arguing, quote, we can't lean into Republican sensationalism, and voting against this political gimmick only fuels GOP misinformation efforts. I'm not worried about GOP attacks, but I'm saddened that this issue got a vote before passing a budget or funding our public schools. If my GOP colleagues were serious about voting rights, they'd be working with Democrats to make sure Carolinians affected by Helene can get to the polls. That's the real story here. Senator Jay Chaudhuri, a Wake County Democrat who has a Republican and Libertarian opponent this election cycle, also voted for the bill, placing the amendment on ballots. He argued that, though a waste of time, it would not have any tangible impact. He said in an email to Indy, we should focus our efforts on legislation, litigation, and election efforts that actually hurt immigrants, pointing out several examples of his advocacy for immigrant voters. As one of the few children of immigrants to serve in the North Carolina General Assembly, I'm well aware of how Republicans have used anti-immigration legislation and rhetoric as a way to turn out their base. The Indy reached out to every Triangle Democrat in the legislature who voted for the measure. Senators Gail Adcock, Dan Blue, Mary Bode, Linda Grafstein, and Mike Woodard, as well as Representatives Alan Buonsi, Allison Dahl, Ray Jeffers, and Tim Longus, did not respond to interview requests. Representative Ya Liu's office asked for a phone interview but didn't call before we published. We didn't also hear back from Senator Rachel Hunt, Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, who was absent from that June 27th vote. Among Triangle Democrats, Senator Natalie Murdoch, as well as Representatives Maria Cervania, Sarah Crawford, Rosa Gill, and Renee Price, joined Meyer and Morey in voting against the amendment proposal. All right, now, folks, I'm going to, it's 20 minutes to go in my broadcast today, talking about election, and Indy Week has recommendations of their own, and you can take into account their political situation, their stance on things. They call themselves a progressive journal. They've made recommendations and endorsements for most of the races involving our immediate area, and I'm just going to read them one after another, and remembering that you can go to, if you don't want to go to the Indy Week's website, indyweek.com, you can replay this particular broadcast that I'm about to do after Friday. All right, and we'll start out with the general election endorsements. They are definitely for Kamala Harris and the national. But this is for the general election, U.S. Congress District 2, Deborah Ross. District 4, Valerie Fouché. Then U.S. District 13, Frank Pierce. That's then the North Carolina State Senate, District 13, Lisa Grafstein. District 14, Dan Blue. District 15, Jay Chaudhuri. District 17, Sydney Batch. District 18, Terrence Everett. District 20, Natalie Murdoch. District 22, Sophia Chitlick. District 23, Greg Meyer. For the NC House, there are 8 competitive state Senate seats and 12 competitive state House seats across these three counties. House District 2, Ray Jeffers. House District 11, Allison Dahl, D-A-H-L-E. District 21, Ya Liu. District 33, Monica Johnson-Hostler. District 34, Tim Longest. District 35, Yvonne Hopkins. District 36, Julie Van Heffen, H-A-E-F-E-N. District 37, Sophia Jackson. District 40, Joe John. District 41, Maria Cervania. District 56, Alan Buansi. District 66, Sarah Crawford. Then in Durham County, special to them, Durham Infrastructure Bonds. They encourage you to vote yes. In Orange County, there's the only competitive race for the Board of County Commissioners this cycle. They recommend Phyllis Porte-Ascott. And then for the Carrboro Town Council, they're recommending Cristobal Palmer. And for the Orange County Schools, Carrboro City School Bonds, vote yes. And Wake County Board of Commissioners, District 6, Shanika Thomas. Wake County Board of Education, District 3, Jordine Blaise, B-L-A-I-S-E. Wake Board of Education, District 4, Toshiba Rice. District 5, Lynn Edmonds. Board of Ed, District 6, Sam Hershey. District 8, Lindsay Mahaffey. Then for Wake Soil and Water Conservation, District Supervisor Mark Boone. Then we have some judgeships. Superior Court Judge, District 10C, Seat 1, Sean Cole. District 10F, Seat 1, Jennifer Bedford. District 10D, Seat 3, Kevin Boxberger. They encourage you to vote yes on the library bond. Over in Cary, municipal bonds should get a yes vote. For the Cary mayor, Janet Cowell is recommended. Then District A, Mitchell Silver. District B, Megan Patton. District C, Corey Branch. And District D, Jane Harrison. District E, they don't have a recommendation there. At large would be Stormy Forte, Jonathan Lambert Melton. And that concludes my, as I can read it off their website, where you could too, the Indy Week's political recommendations for local and a couple of state elections as well. And then I will find us another article to read to finish myself out. Well, except for the multi-million dollars in damages, Helene, at least, has gone by. But this article from Raleigh is about a North Carolina State student, Ethan Clark. And it's written, I don't remember when it was actually published, but it's in today's issue. Weather Authority. 4 weeks ago, Ethan Clark gathered his weather models, leaned over his computer, and attempted to define catastrophe. From hours of watching and analyzing forecasts, Clark, 21, knew that extreme flooding in western North Carolina was inevitable. At the same time, the National Weather Service was releasing alert after alert about the danger of Helene touching down in this area already drenched from rain. Most people, though, don't know what 14 to 20 inches of rain or historic flooding could look like, and it was Clark's job to tell them. Clark, a fourth-year student at North Carolina State University studying meteorology, runs a weather forecasting page called North Carolina's Weather Authority. He says he enjoys doing regular student life things like attending football games, hanging out with friends, but in his 8 years of doing daily weather reports, he hasn't missed a single day. The Facebook page for North Carolina's Weather Authority has reached over 580,000 followers in recent weeks, but many people have followed him since he founded the account 8 years ago at the age of 12. One follower, Annie Ingram, moved to the North Carolina coast in 2019, where she has watched hurricanes become more frequent and intense due to climate change. After losing part of her roof in Hurricane Isaias, she says finding a reliable weather source became a necessity, saying, "I was like, okay, I better buckle down and find something I can trust. After Isaias, I found out about Ethan's account and started following him, and any time we have severe weather, he's always on it with his daily forecast." With Helene on the way, Clark began posting about the risk of heavy rainfall and flash flooding on Tuesday, September 24th, writing in his caption, "Western NC, I'm worried about this much rain. Hopefully the forecast busts." From there, though, his concern only compounded. He tells Indy, "On Wednesday evening, I sounded the alarm and was like, it's going to be bad. I kept saying I was concerned because my followers know that if I'm concerned, crap's really going to hit the fan." He expected a predecessor rain event, that's a PRE, a heavy impact rainfall before a tropical storm's arrival. On Thursday, he stayed up most of the night, tracking Helene as she touched down as a Category 4, barreling up the Gulf Coast of Florida and knocking out roads and cell service along the way. By Friday, she'd made it to western North Carolina as a Category 2, unleashing hell. The death toll from Helene in North Carolina currently stands at 98, with more than 40 still missing, according to Department of Health and Human Services. The situation worsened in the day after the storm due to a lack of running water and flooded roads that left residents stranded. Haunting videos have been shared across news and social media of once vibrant areas like Asheville's River Arts District, almost completely underwater. Some of the hardest hit cities and towns include Black Mountain, Swannanoa, Fairview, Spruce Pine, Hendersonville, Lansing, Burnsville, and Marshall. In Transylvania County, one follower was in touch with Clark right after the storm began to hit. Victoria Arrington lives with her husband and daughter just outside the Brevard city limit and has been following the Weather Authority for 6 or 7 years after noticing Clark's accuracy and what she describes as his lack of excitement in his weather reports. And she says, "The more and more I watched, I was like, this guy's really good. He's breaking everything down. And his accuracy is good. And he never gets excited. That's the thing about Ethan. If he gets excited, it's time to get excited because it's going to happen." Arrington built up a rapport with Clark over the years and was updating him about conditions right up until she lost service. When she regained service in Henderson County Line, 2 days later, she opened her phone to multiple messages from Clark. "There's 2 or 3 messages from Ethan," she says. "He's like, are you guys okay? Are you there? Is everything okay?" Clark has always tried to respond to as many comments and messages as possible. Lately, though, he's getting comments of a different tier, people thanking him for sharing their lives and the lives of loved ones. Clark's interest in weather emerged in third grade while reading forecasts for the elementary school news. From there, he says he read books and taught himself how to make weather graphics. In seventh grade, he began running a weather account called Ethan's Weather for friends and family. Once it began to pick up steam at the end of middle school, he rebranded as North Carolina's Weather Authority and anonymously ran that account all through high school. He says, "I didn't want to be a nerd in high school, so I didn't want my friends to know. It was a massive secret, till it started to sort of get out during one of the severe weather events. People heard my voice, and one of my high school friends recognized it." By the end of high school, his page had amassed around 200,000 followers, at which point Clark finally revealed his identity. One high school teacher, Lisa Patterson, says she still remembers the shock followers felt. Quote, "People thought it was a retired meteorologist when he announced right before he went to college who he was and who was behind North Carolina Weather Authority, people were floored. They were like, oh, my gosh, I didn't know you were a kid. I've been following you for years. You're the most accurate, the most reliable. In high school, Clark was an intern meteorologist for WRAL, where he still works part-time. They, too, take North Carolina's Weather Authority seriously. He said, Patterson says, some of the meteorologists would run their forecast for the week. Then they would ask Ethan, well, what did you get? And they would change their forecast based on what Ethan said. But Clark's most important work happens at his own desk in Raleigh, where he can usually be found, analyzing multiple maps and radars. He blocks out time to devote to weather each day, and if he anticipates a particularly busy week or weather, he will highlight the bad days ahead of time. He says, I plan my plans around trends. I tell my friends, you know just as well as me, if stuff goes bad, I'm not going to be able to come. His process involves hours of looking at every possible model and creating maps, graphics, and reports. He also consults National Weather Service to make sure their forecasts paint a similar picture. He kept up this regimen during Helene, and by the weekend, Clark was flooded with messages. On Saturday, he got a call from a producer at WRAL and left the NC State football game early to compare reports and help them spread information. He says, I was getting thousands and thousands of messages. And the producer says, just come here for like an hour or so and sit here and do whatever you see is important. I found some important stuff, and they shared it. While most of Clark's reports are written posts, he makes videos for extreme weather events, explaining conditions in layman's terms. His video about flooding danger in the mountains was what led Hillsboro resident Tori Winfield to question the safety of her annual girls' trip to Banner Elk, which she and her friends were planning to leave for on Thursday morning. Winfield says, Ethan was talking about landslides and flash flooding and how a lot of deaths occur in vehicles for flash flooding. I didn't feel comfortable driving in that, nor did I feel comfortable having my girlfriends go out ahead of us. Because of Clark's video, Winfield raised the alarm with her friends. Some were completely unaware of the impending weather, and they canceled their Airbnb rental and set off for the coast and said it was surreal. Winfield says, watching everything in western North Carolina unfold that weekend. She says, Ethan posted a picture of Banner Elk and the roads were washed out to where we would have been. We feel like we dodged a bullet there and we were able to come back. Many people weren't so lucky. There are still thousands of National Guard soldiers in western North Carolina aiding in relief efforts like roof clearance, search and rescue, the delivery of resources, and federal assistance for Hurricane Helene exceeded $280 million this month, according to FEMA. Breaking from his regular weather updates, Clark has used his platform to amplify missing person reports, donation requests, county announcements, and even a heartfelt poem from a Transylvania County elementary school teacher about the beauty and resilience of southern Appalachia. He says, I've worked hard because I want people to know how bad it was in western North Carolina. The work did take a toll, though. Normally it's fine, Clark says. The past 2 weeks, I've had no life. It's been pretty much do as much weather as possible, then do as much class as possible, and then go to bed. But no matter what the weather is, Patterson says, Clark's character holds steady. Quote, he's still the same, humble, down-to-earth kid. He's like, I just want to report the weather and let people know. And I don't want them to panic. I want to inform. I want to teach. I just want to keep doing that. And if it happens to save some lives along the way, then that's awesome. Clark plans to graduate from NC State next fall. For as long as he runs North Carolina's Weather Authority, Arrington says she will continue to tune in, always on the lookout for updates about that small town she calls home. And she says, He is a state treasure. We're lucky to have him here in North Carolina. Now I have less than 3 minutes remaining, and I have no time to read an article complete, but I will talk about a PBS series called The M Factor, which debuted on October the 17th. And this one's called Come Sit With Me, about Durham's Omissad Bernie Scott, who invites storytelling around social justice and menopause. So, this is all I'm allowed to read now. It starts, when I first met Omissad Bernie Scott, I was an 8-year-old sitting in an audience at the No Bookstore on Fayetteville Street. She, like my parents, had brought her elementary schooler to learn about resistance and culture at Durham's black-owned southern mecca of diasporic scholarship. Over 2 decades later, our activism would cross paths and contribute to an overlooked intersection of black queerness and an unsung branch of black feminism, conversations about menopause. Continuing the tradition of black storytelling and movement building that defined the institution where we first crossed paths, Bernie Scott is still telling stories through a new lens, a new microphone, and a new perspective in a PBS documentary, The M Factor, which debuted earlier this month. It centers some of the leading voices in the conversation around menopause, like Bernie Scott's. She's also the founder of the podcast and platform Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause. And she spoke, the author, to Bernie Scott for the Indy during Menopause Awareness Month. And for the remainder of that article, you'll have to go to the Indy Week yourself. And our theme music comes up now for our last minute. Enough time for me to tell you that I'm John Feddersen for the ncreadingservice.org. And that again, this broadcast will be aired first on Friday, November 1st, and then will continue as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Where, as I believe I mentioned, you could replay any sections of this or other issues as you please for yourself. I thank you for joining us on this Indie Week independent broadcast. John Feddersen saying so long. Bye-bye.